Babushka's Doll by Patricia Polacco. It wasn't that Natasha was a truly naughty child. She just never understood why she had to wait for things. Babushka, Natasha said, for in Russian, babushka means grandmother. Please stop doing the laundry and push me in the swing. My darling child, Babushka said, I have to do the laundry first. Would you like to help me? No, said Natasha, I want to swing now. Aren't you finished yet? I want to go for a ride in the goat cart. My precious, Babushka said, I must hang up these clothes while the sun is shining. But the sun will be shining all day. I want to go now, Babushka. Take me. Babushka went to feed the goats. Natasha followed. But I'm hungry too, Babushka. My stomach is making noises. I want to eat now. Don't be selfish, darling, said Babushka. These poor creatures need to be fed. They cannot fix their own lunch. Now I'm finished, said Babushka, and now we will have lunch. She took a kettle down from a high shelf. Natasha looked up on the shelf where the kettle had been, and there was a little doll she had never seen before. Is that your doll, Babushka, she asked. Yes, dear, it was my doll when I was a little girl like you. Did you play with her all the time, asked Natasha. No, my dear, I played with her only once. Only once. I've finished my soup now, said Natasha. May I hold the little doll just for a little while? Babushka got the doll down from the high shelf. Yes, it is just the right time for you to play with her, said Babushka. She handed the doll to Natasha. I'm going to the store for groceries, she said. You may play with the doll until I get back. As soon as the door closed behind Natasha's grandmother, something happened. The little doll began to move. She jumped to her feet and did a little dance. For a moment, Natasha was a bit frightened, but then the doll called, Come on, Tasha, let's go out and play. Natasha and the doll ran and ran until Natasha could run no more. As soon as Natasha sat down to catch her breath, the doll said, Get up, Tasha. You get up now. I want to play. I'll swing you on the swing, Natasha said. Whee, the doll squealed. Push harder. I want to go higher. Natasha pushed the doll higher and higher, but soon she grew tired. Don't stop, Tasha, cried the doll. Don't stop. I want you to swing me higher. I'll take you for a ride in the goat cart, Natasha said. Oh, goody, Tasha, the doll chirped. And don't you slow down. You better keep going as long as I want. Do you hear me? As long as I want. Soon, Natasha couldn't lead the goat cart any longer. I have to stop, said Natasha. I need to rest. Now I want to eat, said the doll. Poor Natasha was very tired, but she tried her best to make lunch. Babushka's doll spilled the tea. She sloshed the soup from her spoon, and she flung noodles over her head. Then she pounded her fist in the mess and laughed and laughed. Suddenly, she stopped laughing and started to scream. My dress, Tasha, it's all dirty. I want you to wash it. You wash it right now. Natasha washed the little dress and hung it on the line. Then she ironed it and put it on the doll. You didn't do it right, said the doll. My dress is all wrinkled. Natasha began to cry. I'm just a little girl, she said between sobs. I wish you were just a doll. My darling child, a voice called out. Why are you crying, my precious child? Babushka, stopped, sobbed Natasha. Your little doll came to life and she was very naughty. All she wanted me to do was work. She never let me rest. She made me iron her dress, and I don't even know how. I'm just a little girl. There, there, Babushka said. You must have had a bad dream. Maybe, said Natasha. Her grandmother smiled and held Natasha closer. From now on, you can play with the little doll any time you want. Oh, no, thank you, Babushka, Natasha said. Once is enough. Babushka picked up the little doll and put her back on the high shelf. It looks like you had quite a day, she said softly. The little doll gave Babushka a wink and went back to being just a doll. And Natasha turned out to be quite nice after all. Chester the Brave by Audrey Penn. Chester Raccoon sat snuggled in his mother's lap. The last golden rays of sundown shone through their tree hole, and his younger brother Ronnie lay curled up fast asleep on the far side of their hollow. This is my very best time, Chester told his mother, lifting his eyes to hers. This is my very best time, too, she told him sweetly. Do you still want me to tell you about the little robin? Yes, please. Well, Mrs. Raccoon began her story. He stepped up to the edge of his nest, bent his little legs, lifted his tiny wings, and said, I can't. I'm too afraid, and hopped back into the safety of his nest. He was too afraid to fly, asked Chester. Yes, he was, answered Mrs. Raccoon. Chester looked very worried. He drooped his head and stuck out his lower lip. Did the little robin think it was okay to be afraid? He thought it meant he wasn't brave, explained Chester's mother. You see, the little robin's brother and sister flew their very first time, and he thought that meant they were very brave. And if they were very brave, he thought it meant he wasn't. Chester appeared very upset. Was he right? He asked his mother. Mrs. Raccoon smoothed out the fur on top of Chester's head. Well, the little robin's father told him that it wasn't that his brother and sister were brave. It was the fact that they simply weren't bothered. Chester lifted his head and peered up at his mother. What does that mean? Mrs. Raccoon laughed. The little robin wasn't sure what it meant either, so his father asked him if he was bothered when he was eating worms. Oh, yuck, shrieked Chester. That's disgusting. What did he say? He said he wasn't bothered eating worms at all. He said he loved eating worms, especially the big, long, thick, stretchy kind. Oh, blech, bleated Chester. His nose and mouth twisted and squished together, and his entire body shuddered. Eating worms would bother me. Mrs. Raccoon nodded. It would bother me, too, she confessed. Then the little robin's father asked him if he was bothered when he was singing. And the little birdie began tweeting and said he wasn't bothered when he was singing at all. Well, singing's a lot better than eating worms, grimaced Chester. I agree, said Mrs. Raccoon. Then the little bird's father told him that being brave wasn't about flying when he wasn't bothered to fly. Being brave was about flying when he was bothered to fly, but found the courage to fly anyway because he knew he must. Then his father asked him if he was bothered when he was reciting his flying lessons in front of all the other little birdies who nested in our tree. The poor little robin got all a flutter. He hopped up and down and flapped his wings just like he did this time the skunk sprayed our tree from down below. The little robin said that reciting his lessons in front of all the other little birds was the worst thing he ever had to do in his whole life. Suddenly Chester began to tremble, and he nestled deeper into his mother's soft, comforting arms. What's the matter? His mother asked. Reciting lessons in front of the other animals at Owl Teacher School is the worst thing I ever have to do in my whole life, too, he whimpered. Is that so? Asked Mrs. Raccoon. She gave Chester a reassuring hug and then took his tiny hand in hers and gently kissed the center of his palm. Shall I tell you what happened to the little robin, or would you rather jump on top of Ronnie and wake him up for school? Chester giggled. I want to know what happened to the robin. Well, the very next day, the little robin's mother tucked one of her own tiny flight feathers into his wing and told him it was for good luck. So even though he was still bothered about reciting his lessons, the tiny bird stood in front of all the other birdies in our tree and twittered, I lift my head to the clouds, I push off with my feet, I flap my wings and let the gentle breeze take me for a ride. And while he was still afraid to fly, he found the courage he needed and said to himself, I am very brave. Then he stepped up to the edge of his nest, spread his wings, pushed off with his feet, and flew away. After all, he was a very brave little robin. Hooray! Clapped Chester. Do you know what I think being brave is? Asked Mrs. Raccoon. Chester shook his head. I think being brave is about three little words. Think, tell, do. If you think you can't, tell yourself you can, and do it, Mrs. Raccoon lifted Chester's head. Can you see my kiss in your palm? Chester laughed. No. Well, you know it's there, and it's for luck, just like the robin's little feather. Chester jumped off his mother's lap, bent his knees, opened his arms, and yelled, I am very brave. Then he ran to the other side of the hall and with a flying leap landed on top of his brother. Wake up, Ronnie. It's time for school. Chester the Brave has a speech to make. Later that night, Chester Raccoon stood on a branch at Owl Teacher School. He remembered what his mother said about think, tell, do. If I think I can't, I tell myself I can and do it. And he found the courage he needed to tell himself, I am very brave. Then he opened his hand and there in the middle of his palm was his mother's gentle kiss for good luck. And even though Chester was still the tiniest bit afraid, he recited his lesson in front of all the other animals. After all, Chester is a very brave little raccoon. Cindy Ellen, A Wild Western Cinderella by Susan Lowell. Once there was a rancher who married for his second wife the orneriest woman west of the Mississippi. She was meaner than a rattlesnake, and she had two daughters who were the spitting image of her. The rancher also had a daughter who was just as sweet and gentle as she could be. Her name was Cindy Ellen. Cindy was a pretty good cowgirl, too. Riding her little gray horse, she wrangled and roped and galloped and loped with the best buckaroos on the range. But as soon as the wedding was over, the snaky old stepmother began to pick on poor Cindy Ellen. She was so good, she made her stepsisters look bad. So her stepmother made her do all the dirty work around the ranch. "Mend those fences, tend those cows," she would yell, "and shovel out that corral." The stepsisters never did a lick of work all day. But Cindy didn't dare complain to her daddy, because his new wife wore the pants in the family. When her chores were done, the poor girl used to sit down and rest among the ashes and cinders at the edge of the fireplace, so her older stepsister named her Cinderbottom. The younger sister called her Sanderella, but underneath her dirty old clothes, Cindy Ellen was still as pretty as a peach. Then one day, the biggest cattle king for miles around invited all his neighbors to a two-day celebration. First, a wild and woolly rodeo, and then a square dance, a real Western fandango. Cindy's stepsisters puffed up like two turkey gobblers. Even though they couldn't ride, they decided to gussy themselves up, fit to kill, and enter the rodeo. Nice, patient Cindy Ellen ironed their frilly shirts and frizzed their hair for them. "Don't you wish you could go too, Cinderbottom?" sneered the older sister. "Ah, you're just poking fun at me," said Cindy sadly. "You're right," laughed the younger sister. "Nobody could tell you from a cloud of dust, Sanderella." As soon as they were gone, poor Cindy Ellen broke down and cried. Then suddenly she heard a noise outside, almost like gunfire, but not quite. It wasn't bang, bang, it was more bing, bing. And there stood a little old lady with a golden pistol still smoking in her hand. "Who are you?" gasped Cindy Ellen. "Say hello to your fairy godmother, Sugarfoot," the old lady said. She twirled the pistol, slapped it back into its holster, and took a good hard look at Cindy. "What's the matter with you, honey? You're as down and dirty as a flop-eared hound dog. Stand up straight. Dust yourself off." "I want to go to the rodeo," sobbed Cindy Ellen. "Can you help?" "Maybe see, maybe no," said her fairy godmother. "Magic is plumb worthless without gumption. What you need first, gal, is some gravel in your gizzard. Grit, guts, stop that tomfool blubbering, and let's get busy. Time's a-wasting." She reached for her golden six-gun, and Cindy yelled, "Don't shoot!" But her godmother had already fired straight up in the air. Bing, bing! Glittery sparkles floated down from the sky and sprinkled Cindy all over with fairy dust. Instantly, her heart was filled with strength and happiness, and her rags turned into the finest riding clothes west of the east. A creamy white Stetson hat crowned her shining hair, golden buckskin chaps encircled her legs, and a pretty little pair of cowboy boots hugged her feet like gloves. Buckled to the heel of each boot was a spur that shot out rays of fiery light. Those spurs were set with diamonds as big as sugar lumps. "Now," said her fairy godmother briskly, "where's that horse of yours?" She fired her magic pistol into the air, and zing! Cindy's little gray horse became a little silver horse with a softly sparkling coat. His hoofs glittered as he pawed the ground. "Hit the trail, honey," the old lady said. "Remember, there ain't no horse that can't be rode, and there ain't no man that can't be throwed. And one more thing, get home by midnight, gal, or you'll be sorry." When Cindy Ellen pulled up at the rodeo, everybody turned and stared at the dazzling stranger on the silver horse. The rich rancher's son, a rodeo champion by the name of Joe Prince, came forward wearing the biggest belt buckle you ever saw and swept his hat off his head. "Pleased to meet you, ma'am," he said. "Likewise," said Cindy. Just then, Cindy's older stepsister rode a bucking bronco into the arena, and before she could say, "Oopsie-daisy," that cayuse wrinkled his spine, boiled over, and sent her chasing clouds way up in the sky. Then she bit the dust. Next came the second stepsister, but she couldn't ride a rail fence in a stiff breeze, and pretty soon she was eating gravel just like her sister. Cindy Ellen helped her stepsisters up and brushed them off, but they never even recognized her. Then she remembered her godmother's gift of gumption, and she gave Joe Prince a big daredevil grin. "My turn," said Cindy Ellen. Cindy Ellen climbed aboard a salty bronc with a belly full of bed springs, a real rip snorter. She touched him with her diamond spurs, and first he tried to crow hop. Then he catbacked, and he sunfished, and he windmilled, and he jackknifed. But Cindy stuck to the saddle like a postage stamp. "Ride him, cowgirl," called the crowd. And Cindy Ellen was the winner with every curl in place. Next, with a figure eight, a butterfly, and a wedding ring, she won the trip roping event. And then she and her little horse really burned the breeze. They kicked the jackrabbits right off the trail. They left their shadows 20 miles behind them, and they won the horse race. They even beat Joe Prince. But Joe didn't seem to care. He rode herd on Cindy Ellen right up to the quarter of 12 at night, when she suddenly recalled her godmother's warning and went galloping home. By the time she got home, her fine duds had shriveled into sorry rags again, but she still had plenty of gumption. After a while, her stepsisters hobbled in, all stove up from the rodeo. "Ha, ha, you missed the champion cowgirl," the elder sister jeered. "Nobody knows her name or where she disappeared to." "And that old Joe Prince is eating his heart out," said the younger one. "I bet she comes to the square dance tomorrow night," said Cindy with her new daredevil grin. The next evening, her stepsisters got all dressed up like a sore thumb and strutted away to the dance, leaving Cindy Ella all alone. But not for long. "What's that?" she said, peeking out the window. It looked like a cross between a comet and a dust storm. It sounded like silver bells mixed with dynamite. "Let's get cracking, sweet pea," shouted her fairy godmother. "You're late. Wrestle me up the biggest, dustiest, lumpiest squash you can find." And zingo, the squash became a stagecoach. "Next, we check the trap line," said her godmother. Quick as a wink, she turned 6 cactus mice into 6 dappled horses, a fat rat into a stagecoach driver, and a rough, tough, horned toad into a stagecoach guard riding shotgun beside the driver. "What about my ugly old clothes?" asked Cindy. The old lady answered with a blast of fairy dust that melted into a dress that shone like the sun, the moon, and all the stars together. The skirt floated over petticoats as soft and puffy as summer clouds. A rainbow of jewels glowed around Cindy Ellen's neck, and the little diamond spurs sparkled once more upon her boot heels. "Thank you, ma'am," she cried. The fairy godmother blew the smoke from her pistol, holstered it, and dusted off her hands. "Remember, Miss Cindy, pretty as pretty does," she said. "Magic can backfire, midnight or bust." Cindy promised, and the stagecoach rumbled away. When Cindy Ellen arrived at the Cattle King's square dance, the fiddlers were tuning up for a toe-tapping jamboree. Joe Prince reached for Cindy's hand the instant he laid eyes on her. "Buckle on your partners, fellows," he called, "and tell them to hang on. Let's shake our hoofs like lightning until the early dawn." And Cindy answered, "Hurry up, cowboy, don't be slow. All I'm on left and do-si-do." Hand over hand and heel over heel, Joe and Cindy danced the daisy chain, the whirl-away, the curlicue, and the grand sachet. They made their feet go whickety-whack. "Swing 'em, boys," cried Cindy, "and do it right." And Joe called back, "Swing those girls till the middle of the night." Twirling, swirling, Cindy Ellen lost track of time until all at once she heard the clock begin to strike 12. She hightailed out of there lickety-split. "Whoa," yelled Joe, hot on her heels, but he couldn't catch her. One of the diamond spurs fell off Cindy's boot as she ran, though, and Joe picked it up carefully out of the dust. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, not a particle remained of Cindy's gorgeous outfit, except for the second diamond spur, which she tucked away in her hip pocket. Pretty soon, word got out that the champion cowgirl was a wanted woman. She'd left Joe Prince so lovelorn that he was tracking her through the territory, and he vowed to marry the horsewoman whose boot fitted the little diamond spur. He tried it on many a foot, but not one could wear it. At last, he came riding up to Cindy's father's place. "Go shovel out the stable," hissed the stepmother, and Cindy reluctantly obeyed. First, Joe tried the diamond spur on the youngest stepsister, but no matter how he stretched the straps, her hoof was too big. The older sister had crushed her feet into little bitty boots, so just for an instant the spur almost fitted, but then her boots split open, her toes popped out like puppies from a basket, and Joe Prince muttered, "Sorry," and headed for the door. "My turn," said a voice that stopped him in his tracks. It was Cindy Ellen. And although her mean stepsisters almost died laughing, Joe let Cindy have her chance fair and square, and when he put the diamond spur around her dainty little boot, it fitted perfectly. Then she pulled out the second diamond spur and buckled it onto her other boot. And at that very moment, Cindy's little horse gave a whinny, and everyone heard a noise like, "Wingo, wingo, kazing!" Let her rip, shouted Cindy Ellen's fairy godmother, brandishing her golden pistol. Hold your fire, yelled Joe Prince. But glittering sparks of fairy dust were already sprinkling down everywhere. They turned Cindy's clothes from cotton to satin, and they put quite a twinkle in Joe's eye. And Cindy's horse began to sparken. Yee-haw, yelled the fairy godmother. So Cindy Ellen and Joe Prince got hitched and lived happily ever after in a ranch house full of love and rodeo trophies. Cindy's family moved to town where both stepsisters married city slickers, and Cindy's little horse kept his sparkling coat and his glittering hoofs to the end of his days. Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, written by Judy Barrett. We were all sitting around the big kitchen table. It was Saturday morning, pancake morning. Mom was squeezing oranges for juice. Henry and I were betting on how many pancakes we each could eat. And Grandpa was doing the flipping. Seconds later, something flew through the air, headed toward the kitchen ceiling, and landed right on Henry. After we realized that the flying object was only a pancake, we all laughed, even Grandpa. Breakfast continued quite uneventfully. All the other pancakes landed in the pan, and all of them were eaten, even the one that landed on Henry. That night, touched up by the pancake incident at breakfast, Grandpa told us the best tall-tale bedtime story he had ever told. Across an ocean, over lots of huge, bumpy mountains, across three hot deserts and one smaller ocean, there lay the tiny town of Chew and Swallow. In most ways, it was very much like any other tiny town. It had a main street lined with stores, houses with trees and gardens around them, a schoolhouse, about 300 people, and some assorted cats and dogs. But there were no food stores in the town of Chew and Swallow. They didn't need any. The sky supplied all the food they could possibly want. The only thing that was really different about Chew and Swallow was its weather. It came three times a day, at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Everything that everyone ate came from the sky. Whatever the weather served, that's what they ate. But it never rained rain, it never snowed, and it never blew just wind. It rained things like soup and juice. It snowed mashed potatoes and green peas. And sometimes the wind blew in storms of hamburgers. The people could watch the weather report on television in the morning, and they would even hear a prediction for the next day's food. When the townspeople went outside, they carried their plates, cups, glasses, forks, spoons, knives, and napkins with them. That way they would always be prepared for any kind of weather. If there were leftovers, and there usually were, the people took them home and put them in the refrigerator in case they got hungry between meals. The menu varied. By the time they woke up in the morning, breakfast was coming down. After a brief shower of orange juice, low clouds of sunny-side-up eggs moved in, followed by pieces of toast. Butter and jelly sprinkled down for the toast, and most of the time it rained milk afterwards. For lunch one day, Frankfurters, already in their rolls, blew in from the northwest at about 5 miles an hour. There were mustard clouds nearby. Then the wind shifted to the east and brought in baked beans. A drizzle of soda finished off the meal. Dinner one night consisted of lamb chops, becoming heavy at times with occasional ketchup. Periods of peas and baked potatoes were followed by gradual clearing with a wonderful jello setting in the west. The sanitation department of Chew and Swallow had a rather unusual job for a sanitation department. It had to remove the food that fell on the houses and sidewalks and lawns. The workers cleaned things up after every meal and fed all the dogs and cats. Then they emptied some of it into the surrounding oceans for the fish and turtles and whales to eat. The rest of the food was put back into the earth so that the soil would be richer for the people's flower gardens. Life for the townspeople was delicious until the weather took a turn for the worse. The Chew and Swallow Digest. Spaghetti ties up town. Record-breaking pasta fall causes chaos. Traffic snarled on Lower Intestine Street. One day there was nothing but gorgonzola cheese all day long. The next day there was only broccoli, all overcooked. And the next day there were Brussels sprouts and peanut butter with mayonnaise. Another day there was a pea soup fog. Nobody could see where they were going, and they could barely find the rest of the meal that got stuck in the fog. The food was getting larger and larger, and so were the portions. The people were getting frightened. Violent storms blew up frequently. Awful things were happening. One Tuesday, there was a hurricane of bread and rolls all day long and into the night. There were soft rolls and hard rolls, some with seeds and some without. There was white bread and rye and whole wheat toast. Most of it was larger than they had ever seen bread and rolls before. It was a terrible day. Everyone had to stay indoors. Roofs were damaged, and the sanitation department was beside itself. The mess took the workers 4 days to clean up, and the sea was full of floating rolls. To help out, the people piled up as much bread as they could in their backyards. The birds picked at it a bit, but it just stayed there and got staler and staler. There was a storm of pancakes one morning and a downpour of maple syrup that nearly flooded the town. A huge pancake covered the school. No one could get it off because of its weight, so they had to close the school. Lunch one day brought 15-inch drifts of cream cheese and jelly sandwiches. Everyone ate themselves sick, and the day ended with a stomachache. There was an awful salt and pepper wind, accompanied by an even worse tomato tornado. People were sneezing themselves silly and running to avoid the tomatoes. The town was a mess. There were seeds and pulp everywhere. The sanitation department gave up. Their job was too big. Everyone feared for their lives. They couldn't go outside most of the time. Many houses had been badly damaged by giant meatballs. Stores were boarded up, and there was no more school for the children. So a decision was made to abandon the town of Chew and Swallow. It was a matter of survival. The people glued together the giant pieces of stale bread, sandwich style with peanut butter, took the absolute necessities with them, and set up on their rafts for a new land. After being afloat for a week, they finally reached a small coastal town which welcomed them. The bread had held up surprisingly well enough for them to build temporary houses for themselves out of it. The children began school again, and the adults all tried to find places for themselves on the new land. The biggest change they had to make was getting used to buying food at a supermarket. They found it odd that the food was kept on shelves, packaged in bottles, cans, and boxes. Meat that had to be cooked was kept in large refrigerators. Nothing came down from the sky except rain and snow. The clouds above their heads were not made by fried eggs. No one ever got hit by a hamburger again. And nobody dared go back to Chew and Swallow to find out what had happened to it. They were too afraid. Henry and I were awake until the very end of Grandpa's story. I remember his goodnight kiss. The next morning, we woke up to see snow falling outside our window. We ran downstairs for breakfast and ate it a little faster than usual so we could go sledding with Grandpa. It's funny, but even as we were sliding down the hill, we thought we saw a giant pat of butter at the top, and we could almost smell mashed potatoes.